Tam to tam je.
I think it's too high. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay, this is good. You could turn those lights off. Okay. Okay, so I'll begin with the salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, today we will be doing the Chula Gosenga Sutta. Was that was announced by Baus in the email? It was the Chula Gosenga Sutta.
Yes. So the 31 and
32. Excuse me?
31 and 32.
Right, okay. Because I realized I had sutta number 30 originally on the list, but then I think I took that off last week so that we could catch up. Okay, so this is a sutta which doesn't have a very deep philosophical content, but rather it's important because it shows the kind of harmony that should exist, firstly within the Sangha as the monastic order, but also it serves as a kind of what I would call a model for harmony in human affairs in general, though it's very seldom that one finds such a high degree of harmony. Even when you have a small group of monastics together, there's almost bound to be some reason for quarrels and disputes to break out. Is that so? Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha was living at a place called Nātika in the dwelling called the brick house. And on that occasion, there were three monks. The most prominent of them is named Venerable Anuruddha, and his two companions are Venerable Nandiya and Venerable Kimbila. Okay, so they were all living together in a place called the forest or woods of the Gosinga sal trees. The sal tree, it's a very beautiful tree that grows in northern India. It has a very sweet scent, very beautiful flower. And so when all the trees are blossoming, then the forest becomes pervaded by this almost divine scent. And of these three monks, the only one who appears elsewhere in the Nikayas with a prominent role is Venerable Anuruddha. Venerable Anuruddha was a cousin of the Buddha. He was a member of the Sakyan clan, and like other Sakyans, he grew up in a great deal of luxury. And after the Buddha had left the home life and then become enlightened, and when he came back to visit his relatives in the city of Kapalabhattu, his birthplace, the place where he grew up, a great number of the Sakyans went forth and became monks under the Buddha, because the Buddha had become a very prestigious spiritual teacher, and so all of the families thought that it was almost obligatory for one of their sons to go forth and become a monk. Then Anuruddha had an older brother whose name was Mahanama, and so the two of them discussed together which one should become a monk. And Anuruddha was originally hesitant to become a monk. So he said to Mahanama, "Why don't you become a monk and I'll stay and live the home life, live the household life." So Mahanama said, "Well, okay, if that's what you want, we'll do it that way. But let me explain to you a little bit about your responsibilities if you remain in the household life. Our family owns a great number of fields, so when the spring comes, you have to see that the fields are all plowed, and you have to do, every day you have to check the fields, make sure that they're plowed properly. Then as the crops are growing, you have to make sure that they're watered every day. You have to make sure that every day that they get sufficient fertilizer. Then when the crops start to grow, when they're full grown, then you have to supervise the harvesting of the crops. You have to make sure that they're all collected, bundled, brought into the storeroom. Then you have to oversee the threshing of the crops. You have to oversee the discarding of the waste. Then you have to see that the crops, some are sold on the market, others are distributed to the families. Then, by that time, it's almost time for the next plowing season. So you have to start to see that, again, that the fields are properly plowed, that the seed is sown, that the crops grow properly, etc., etc., etc." Then Anuruddha asked, somewhat in a mood of exasperation, "Doesn't this ever come to an end?" Then Mahanama said, "No, it doesn't come to an end. It goes on this way year after year after year." Then Anuruddha said, "Okay, you stay and look after the crops. I'll become a monk." Okay, so then Anuruddha went forth and became a monk under the Buddha. And he had a special skill which he developed very early, and that is that he immediately was able to enter into deep states of meditation. And after attaining these states of deep meditation, the jhanas, then he was able to open up what is called the Dipa Chakhu, the divine eye. And so with the divine eye, he was able to see other world systems, other realms of existence. He was able to see distant galaxies. Do you know the Hubble telescope? What would it be like to have, you don't really have to rely on a telescope, but you just go into kind of deep meditation, and then you just open up a Hubble telescope within your own inner vision, and then you can see distant galaxies, and you move your vision out to those distant galaxies. Then you see beyond them other galaxies, and you move further out to those galaxies. Then you see what looks like stars in the distance, and you move further out to those stars, but they turn out to be galaxies in turn. So this was the kind of vision that Anuruddha had. But even though he had this divine vision, he had to struggle very hard to achieve arhatship. There's a sutta it comes in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Threes, where Anuruddha complains to Venerable Sariputta. He says that, I have this divine eye by which I can see thousands of world systems, and yet I'm not able to reach the extinction of the defilements. Oh, he says, yeah, I have this divine eye by which I can see distant world systems. I'm very energetic, very mindful, and yet I'm unable to reach the extinction of defilements. Then Sariputta tells him that you have this attachment to the divine eye. That is a hindrance to you. Because you're so skilled in meditation. What's making that sound? Mm-hmm. Okay. Because you're so skilled in meditation, that's bringing a subtle mana, a subtle conceit in you. And the fact that you haven't reached the extinction of the defilements, that's causing a subtle excitement or a subtle worrying in you, a restlessness. So you should get rid of your attachment to the divine eye. You should get rid of your pride because of your skill in meditation. And you should stop worrying that you haven't reached the extinction of defilements, but just continue to practice in a very straight way. And so Anuruddha then followed the advice of Sariputta, and then before long he was able to reach the extinction of the defilements. But even during that period when he was practicing, several times he had to be helped by the Buddha. We have in the Majjhima Nikaya, there is a sutta that comes towards the end, I think it's 127, 128. Yes, 127. It's 128, where the Buddha goes to visit Anuruddha and his friends when they're meditating in solitude, and then they report to the Buddha that they're having certain exceptional experiences in meditation, but they don't know how to overcome them and to develop wisdom or insight. Then the Buddha gives them advice. And then there's another sutta that comes in the Anguttara Nikaya in the Book of Eights, where Anuruddha, again, he was meditating in solitude, and then seven thoughts occurred to him, which are called thoughts of a great man, a great person. That this Dharma is for one with few wishes, not for one with many desires. This Dharma is for one who is content, not for one who is discontent. The Dharma is for one who is energetic, not for one who lacks energy. The Dhamma is for one who is fond of solitude, not for one who is fond of company. The Dhamma is for one who is energetic, not for one who lacks energy. The Dhamma is for one who is mindful, not for one who lacks mindfulness. For one who has samadhi, concentration, not for one who lacks concentration. And for one who has wisdom, not for one who lacks wisdom. So those were seven thoughts of a great person that Anuruddha had. Then the Buddha came to Anuruddha, I think by supernormal power, and told him that he should remember the eighth thought of a great person. And that is that this Dhamma is for one who delights in the absence of mental proliferation, the absence of conceptual fabrication, not for one who delights in conceptual proliferation or conceptual constructions. And so these then became the eight thoughts of the great person. Okay, so this sutta that we're going to read today takes place when Anuruddha and his two friends had already achieved arhatship. But as we'll see as we go along, none of them has reported to the other about their attainment of arhatship. Okay, so now the sutta tells us that one day in the evening, the Buddha rose from his meditation. He was living in the monastery together with a large number of monks. And the commentary says that the Buddha simply got up very early, put away all of his belongings, took his extra robe and his alms bowl, and left the dwelling place without reporting to anybody. He didn't tell Sariputta, didn't tell Ananda, but he just took off by himself. Why does the Buddha do this? Because sometimes he just likes to wander alone and to go anonymously, not surrounded by a crowd. You know, being a Buddha, it's really like a terrible burden. You know, everybody thinks, I want to be a Buddha. I want to be a Buddha so I could be like the... like every American kid wants to be president when he grows up. Thinks, I want to be president. I want to be president. And so that's the glory, like every mother tells the kid, you're in America, anybody can be president. So we have a talented young kid who he's very successful in school, goes on to college, the best college, goes on to Harvard Law School, gets his law degree, starts working his way up through the political ladder, thinking, I've got to be president. He's popular. He wins the affection of many people. So when the convention comes, they nominate him for the candidate. He runs for first in the primary. He gets the primary selection. Then he goes into the election, the presidential election, thinking, I've got to run. You know, during the campaign, you have to work like about 20, 21 hours a day, maybe 3 or 4 hours of sleep per night, very restless sleep also, thinking what you have to do the next day, until finally the election in November comes around, you win the presidency, then you get to be president, there's great celebration, all of your followers are popping champagne corks, celebrating. For about 2 months, November, December, January, you're celebrating, very happy, making preparations to move into the White House. Then you get into the White House, you have that first night, the great inauguration, balls and dancing and celebration and all the movie actors, movie actresses, prominent sports stars, musicians, personalities all come to your balls and everybody is so happy celebrating. But then the next day you step into the White House, eager, enthusiastic, but then there come the attacks, the criticisms, the obstinacy, the crises break out here, there. Oh, there's a problem with Iran, problem with Israel and Palestine, and problems with, could be Katrina or Gulf oil spills or this policy, that problem. And you wonder, do I have to go through this another day? But you know, one always is attached to one's name in history, so then 4 years of that, you think you would just want to resign and go, go live in a monastery. But then you have to think, now the next presidential election is coming, I have to run for re-election, and we go through this turmoil all again. Till then, if you win the re-election and you go through another 4 years of that, then after 8 years you resign, and it seems all like a bad dream has passed. So being like a Buddha, it's a little bit like being like the American president, except that it comes not so much through personal ambition, but through great vows and great aspirations. But still you think, when I'm a Buddha, then I will be, you know, at the center of the spiritual universe. Everybody will be making offerings to me. I'll have so many hundreds of monastic disciples, maybe thousands of monastic disciples, hundreds and thousands of lay disciples. Devas will be coming to me. Brahmas will be coming to me. The kings of all of the states of India will be venerating me. But then when you get to be Buddha, you think, wow, I just want a little peace and quiet. Yeah, so every once in a while, the Buddha thinks to himself, I'm tired of being surrounded by monks and nuns, lay followers, lay male followers, lay female followers, kings and princes and ordinary people, and getting in these arguments with followers of the other sects, having to settle conflicts within the Sangha. Let me just go off and live in solitude. Like there's a well-known sutta, or an incident that's reported in the Vinaya, where there was a big conflict taking place in the city of Kosambi, which divided the Sangha very bitterly. And the Buddha tried to reconcile the two factions, but they just said to the Buddha, you stay out of it. This is our business. We could settle this ourselves. And then the Buddha, he thought of the elephant, sometimes the king of the elephant herd, chief elephant, is always surrounded by other male elephants which are struggling, competing with him, trying to drive him out of the position of being the king of the herd. Female elephants who are always trying to win his affection. Baby elephants that are always sort of misbehaving in his presence. And sometimes that bull elephant thinks, let me just abandon the herd and go off by myself. And so the Buddha thought of the king elephant in this way, and then thought, let me also go off and stay by myself. And so the Buddha left the monastery, left the quarreling monks to themselves, and went off to stay in a place called the Parilayaka forest. And while he was staying there, there were nobody to serve him, nobody to attend on him, except an elephant came to serve him, and a monkey. Okay, so at this time too, the Buddha would have been a bit wary of living together with the whole Sangha, and so he just wanted to go off on his own. And if he were to report to the others, then they would say, oh, let us go with you. Oh, you can't go off by yourself. And then he wouldn't have had the solitude that he wanted. This it reminds me of the time during my first years as a monk in Sri Lanka. I was living in this little temple. It's in the countryside, a little distance away from the village. And so I thought I wanted to go for a walk just to see what the village was like, to go past the village out into the countryside. I didn't quite know the conventions of with the way that lay people interact with the monks or what they expect from the monks. And so as I go walking through the countryside, I'm passing, you know, I get out of the village coming into the countryside, and people see me walking and then they say, Handane, that means Venerable One, Enda, Teyekak Bhuva, Bhonda, Teyekak Bhonda, Bhante, please come to our house and drink a little tea. So you feel like you have to oblige them. So you go to the house, they serve you some tea, then they say, Handane, Enda, Vadinda, Vadinda, Api Pansala Handru, Humba Vendavani. Pante, please come and meet the chief monk of our temple. And so to make them happy, you have to say, Handai, Hari, Kai, Kai, yeah. So you go to the temple, and you go to the, come to the temple, and the chief monk says, Teyekak, Teyekak Ona. Would you like to drink a little tea? And of course, to be polite, you have to say, yes. So you drink a little tea and chat a little, chit-chat with the chief monk till finally you take your leave and you depart, walk a little further. Somebody else comes out from the house and says, Handru, Koheda Wadine, Bhante, where are you going? Mama, I've got to take a walk. Avidinda tikakone. I want to take a little walk. Oh, Handru. Api gaitara et vadinda teyakakunda. Venerable, please come to our house and drink a little tea. So it becomes very difficult to get away. Okay, so here the Buddha, fortunately, he's not walking apparently through woodland, so he's not going to be held back by people inviting him to come to their house to drink some tea. So finally he comes to this park of the Gosenga sal tree wood. And then there's a park keeper here. It seems to be like a reserve. And they assign this park keeper in order to protect the park so that people from the village don't come to cut down the trees and take the wood to their house to use for firewood. Okay, so when he comes, then the park keeper sees the Buddha coming and just he addresses him as recluse ascetic. Do not enter the park. There are three young men here who are seeking their own good. In other words, these are like three ascetics living in the forest who are meditating to reach some kind of higher realization. And so he says, do not disturb them. Okay, but Anuruddha must have been tuned in to the, do you call this the mind-controlled internet, mind-controlled television? And so he was able, with his divine eye and divine ear, to see what was taking place outside the forest, to hear this conversation. And so he would have come to the edge of the forest, and he told the park keeper, please do not prevent the teacher from coming in. This is our teacher, the Buddha. Okay, and so then Anuruddha goes to the other monks, reports to them, and then they all come out to meet the Buddha and sort of welcome him and lead him into the forest. Okay, then they bring him to their dwelling place. They show him the usual courtesies that are due to a teacher. You know, they bow down to him. They provide him with water. they wash his feet, and then they exchange the courtesies, courteous greetings, and then the Buddha says to them, I hope you're not meeting any trouble in getting alms food. That's the ordinary way in which wandering monks would greet one another. Anuruddha says, we're keeping well, we're not having any trouble getting alms food. Okay, then the Buddha brings up the important topic of this conversation. He says, I hope that you are all living in concord, in harmony, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes or with friendly eyes. And we often meet this description in the text where it's sometimes contrasted with another description. That is the description of monks who are arguing and fighting. I think we'll see this in Sutta number 128. Yeah, on page 1008, the very first paragraph, where it says, on that occasion, the monks at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. Like their tongues become knives or swords. And so when they speak to one another, they're insulting each other, abusing each other, reviling each other, speaking harshly to one another. But in contrast, we have the monks who are blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly, friendly eyes. Okay, so Anuruddha replies that they're able to live together in this kind of harmony. And then the Buddha asks, how are you able to do so? Okay, then Anuruddha explains. He says, what I do, Bhante, is that I think it is a gain for me, a great gain for me, that I am living with such companions in the holy life, with such fellow monastics. Then he mentions three ways in which they live together in harmony. He says, I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately, and I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. Okay, the key word here is the well-known word metta. Usually when we think of metta, or we hear about metta in Buddhism, we immediately think that it means doing a particular type of meditation. Like, what kind of meditation do you practice? What is your practice? Oh, my practice is loving-kindness meditation, metta bhavana. But the person might not pay much attention to how they act and interact with others. But the Buddha speaks about three ways of developing metta, three ways of practicing metta. that the three ways of practicing metta are metta kaya kamma, that's bodily action, which is, can you read it? Oh, let me turn it to a different angle. Is this better?
Yes. Yeah.
Is it better for everybody? Yeah, and make sure, okay, after you get the camera on this, then don't leave it on that, because then the reflection comes. So, and then those people who are viewing on the internet have trouble seeing. Okay, so there's metta kaya kamma, that means loving kindness through bodily action. And metta vachi kamma, loving kindness expressed in speech. And metta mano kamma, loving kindness in thoughts. And then each one is to be practiced in both ways, he says, towards them both openly and privately. So, for example, one can practice loving kindness by bodily action openly, by, say, if one of the other monks gets sick, then his companion might bring him some hot water, bring him some medicines, might call a doctor to come to see him. If he's carrying some heavy load that he can't manage all by himself, he might help him to carry the load. So this is doing good, kind deeds towards him openly. And he could do also good deeds towards him secretly. For example, if maybe somebody could think of how would you practice loving kindness towards somebody privately or secretly, so that they don't, it's not done openly.
You do things like arranging their chair.
Yeah.
For their life.
Yeah.
You know, like arranging their things and putting on food and so on.
And?
Well, like putting sweet things in the fridge for them.
Yeah.
Infinite number of ways.
Any other ideas?
When you say prayers.
Excuse me?
Say prayers.
This is bodily action. Yeah, okay, that's a good idea. Okay. Like sometimes.
Or carry somebody's, my next door neighbor's an elderly lady, so like I'll put in her garbage things sometimes.
Yeah, those are some good examples. And so in Buddhism, we attach like a special significance to doing good deeds for others, almost secretly, without seeking any kind of recognition, acknowledgement for what we do. Okay, then there's maintaining loving acts of speech towards others, both openly and privately. Openly, of course, means you speak to them gently, in friendly ways, with a soft voice, inquiring after their well-being. And how does one speak loving words to them privately or secretly?
You can praise them to others.
Right, okay, that's a good example. So you speak highly of them to others. Any other ways this might be done? Any ideas?
You could take the blame for something that they did, that experienced it. actually saw the dummy once. I made a mistake.
Yeah.
I dropped something in the company with someone else, and later when they were explaining what happened, they said, we dropped the thing. Mm. It's just me. They're just in me, but they said, we dropped the thing. And we dropped it.
Oh, that's a good, a very good and unusual example. Any other ideas?
Can you do it negatively by refraining when you really want to go after them? Or, I mean,
that would be more a kind of restraint, but this seems to be a positive action. Yeah. Anyway, I can't think of any myself.
You can advocate. I mean, speaking as a mother, sometimes you can explain what someone did in the way, you know, make it more understandable. Or
oh, that's a good example. Yeah, yeah.
Advocate.
Or if somebody is, say, impinging on the rights or the well-being of one of your friends or contacts or even just an acquaintance, and you regard this as being unfair or unjust, then you can speak up in defense of that person. Mm-hmm. It's not the same as praising them, but you are advocating for their rights, for their welfare.
Or at least mitigating the harm.
Yeah, yeah. So that's an expression of loving kindness in speech. Did you have some idea? You were wrong.
I don't know if this is considered privately, but say if either a political leader or a leader of a movement give an idea through speech that will better the welfare of people in general. And people in general don't really know that they're benefiting from this speech.
Mm. Okay, this could be an example of a leader who speaks up on behalf of a great number of people.
Not on behalf of them, but say they speak of issues about climate warming, global warming.
Yeah.
It's not on any specific person, but people benefit from this philosophy greatly.
Yeah, this is, I understood what you mean. Like, say, people who are distant from our place of residence, people in India, Africa, who would be greatly harmed by increased global warming. So if we advocate policies that will control global warming on their behalf, we could say that this is an act of loving kindness of speech.
Or a teacher, like you, teaching the merits of loving kindness, and then we in turn do things.
Yeah.
So you're not specifically saying something, people don't really know that we're actually, they're benefiting from your speech to us, teaching. Mm.
Okay, maybe one example just occurred to me just now when you said that. Maybe it just exemplifies what you said, but it refers to a specific person. You know, it's a terrible thing that there's a woman in Iran, who's accused of adultery, and they want to bury her in sand with only the head emerging from the sand, and then they want to stone her to death. Now this organization Avas has circulated a petition, spreading over the internet for people to sign, protesting against that, and then eventually they want to collect 100,000 signatures and then submit it to the authorities in Iran.
I think I read that they're not going to stone her.
They still
want to
kill her.
But there are 15 other people who are sort of on the lineup to be stoned to death. I think that they haven't yet been convicted, but if they are convicted, then they will be subject to stoning to death. So the petition also covers them. Okay, so this is loving kindness, both openly and privately, in speech. And then there's mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. Okay, here the problem is just the opposite. Mental acts of loving kindness towards others openly.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fear, maybe people can feel it. It's just about the loving mind.
If you can change your intention, you know, in your work.
Yeah.
I know in my work as an editor, I try to shift towards doing good.
Yeah.
Selecting articles that really help.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
So would that be a mental act that one's intention turns towards metta?
But is that openly? I'm not sure.
Because it manifests. Manifestation.
Yeah, actually, it seems that there's sort of like complex intersections of bodily, verbal, and mental. So it begins with the mental, but then if you select an article, you know, you pass it on to the copy editor or something, or to the people who work on the magazine. That might be called verbal. But probably we would say it's basically a mental act. Yeah, but I think that refusal to speak could be considered, even though one is not speaking, but it's a verbal act because it's a restraint over speech. I know what I would think is that the mental act openly means that you radiate or generate loving kindness towards them when you're in their presence. Whereas when you do it privately, when, you know, you might be in your room and then you just think of them with loving kindness. Particularly if one generates the loving kindness towards them as a meditative practice. Okay, so these three principles belong to a set of six principles that the Buddha teaches time and again in the suttas. They're called sometimes the six principles of cordiality and harmony and respect. I think you have them in Chinese. Liu He, is that what they're called? Okay. Excuse me?
It's a postulate.
Yeah. That's right, yeah, yeah. Okay, so in the order in which they come in Pali, it's the loving kindness of bodily action, verbal action, mental action, then harmony through observing the same precepts, or observing precepts together, harmony through sharing one's gains. This is especially the case for monastics. Whenever one gets any kind of gains, even things on alms round, like the content of a bowl, the alms bowl, then one should share it with the other monks. And then there's the harmony in views, having a common understanding. In the case of Buddhism, based on, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the three characteristics. Okay, but here only three of these are mentioned. Then Anuruddha goes on to explain more concretely how they're able to live in harmony. And this is expressed very beautifully. He says that, you know, when they're mixing together, he says, he thinks, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? And he says, then I set aside what I want to do and I do what they want to do. In this way, even though we are different in body, but we become one in mind. You know, this isn't intended as a kind of metaphysical proposition that we all have one mind and only the bodies are different. But it's more, you might call this a common sense proposition that we all agree to agree on what we're going to do, instead of putting forward our own purposes, our own intentions. I find out what the others want to do, and then we reach a kind of consensus. And so each one submits to the will of the others. And since they're all people of wisdom, loving kindness, who seek the good of the group, you don't have to be aware that one is going to be exploiting the others and trying to using the, to use the others to fulfill his own private ends. You know, the basic sort of underlying principle of American democracy, modern democracy, is that society consists of different factions, people with different interests. Each person is pursuing his own self-interest, and each group is pursuing its self-interest. Sort of the theory is that when everyone pursuing their own self-interest gets together it to form a society, a state, somehow there's like this magic, what they call it, the hidden, the invisible hand. This is behind the market or behind
the
state.
Yeah. Hand of the marketplace?
Yeah, the invisible hand of the market. But also it's supposed to be like the invisible hand in the democracy that ensures that each person pursuing their own self-interest or the interest of their group, somehow all of these interests will balance each other out, and so everybody will gain from it. But does it work in reality? It depends on how much money one has and the power of the particular organization to which one belongs, the power and wealth. But here, this shows, like, I think the true way in which the interests of all are served is that is when each one seeks not his own self-interest, but the interest of the group. And this way they can truly harmonize and truly promote the well-being and harmony of the group. Okay, so then that's how Anuruddha explains their ability to live together in harmony. Okay, then the Buddha asks, I hope that you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. I have to say, it seems to me that something is a bit misplaced in the way the sutta has been transmitted, because this expression, dwelling diligent, ardent, and resolute, usually refers to the dedication to meditation practice. And yet the way Anuruddha is going to answer this in the first place, it doesn't relate to meditation practice, but it's more an expression of their group harmony in the way they conduct their everyday affairs. So this seems to illustrate better the way they live together through bodily acts, verbal acts, and even mental acts of loving kindness, rather than dwelling ardent, diligent, and resolute, which will come later. So, anyway, in reply to that question, Anuruddha replies that this is the way they live, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Then he explains their routine on the alms route. He says, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. So apparently they go out separately on alms round, which might be the old style in which it was done. Nowadays, usually when monks living in a monastery, even it could be a large monastery with 100 monks, when they go out on alms round, they'll usually go in large groups in a single file line. But here, since they're apparently going separately in separate directions, they come back at maybe slightly different times, and then they have the seats put away, and so then they have to set up the seats, and they don't have tap water, but they have to go maybe to a well or to a storage place where they keep the water, take the water for drinking, and then other water for washing, and then they put out something like a garbage bin for any food that will be left over. Okay, then the one who returns last, if he doesn't get enough alms food himself, he could eat the food which is left over. Otherwise, if there are leftovers, then he will put it into the refuse bucket and then throw it away where there's no greenery or he'll put it into water where there is no light. Actually, it seems to me that the way, the better way to put away the excess food is to put it someplace in the woods or the forest where animals will get it. But one has to be careful what kind of animals there are, because where I used to live in Sri Lanka, we used to have the problem with the monkeys. Terrible, terrible creature. So the place where I was staying, we first used to put the food out, and then the monkeys would come and they would eat it and fight amongst themselves. And usually it's the big tough monkey always has to get the food first, and he'll push away the smaller monkeys, and he makes first claim on the best food if he sees a smaller monkey coming to get the food. Have you ever seen monkeys in the wild? Not even in Taiwan? Are there monkeys in Taiwan? There are. He'll come, he'll jump, and show his teeth, you know, snarling and show his teeth. And if the little monkey comes to get it, he'll jump on the little monkey, sometimes bite the back of the little monkey, and chase the little monkey away. Till he's had his full, then he'll go off, and then the other monkeys come. And I'm sorry to say this, but you know, we speak about patriarchal society as though we're like a human invention, but we could see it in the monkeys, monkey world. It's the big male monkeys who get the food first, and then the females get the food after the big male monkeys have gotten it, and then they take the food for their children. But the big male monkeys don't care whether the children get food or not. Okay, and then what happens if the monkeys are not given their regular food? Then they get very angry and vindictive, and they come to the place where you're living, and they pound on the roof, pound on the door. Yes, truly, truly. I'm not exaggerating. And the place where I was staying, there was this kind of, the roof was made out of these asbestos corrugated tiles, and they would go to the edge of the roof and pick it up if they didn't get enough, and they would pound it. And usually, often after the meal, I want to take a little quiet rest. And so I would be lying down, and resting, and then suddenly I hear this stomping on the roof. Then they come to the edge of the roof, and then we get this heavy pounding. And sometimes the monkeys, if they get really angry, they'll attack the human being. They don't really intend harm for the human being, but they just want to get some kind of vengeance if you're not feeding them properly. So that's why it's a little risky to put the food out if there are monkeys around. You have to keep, if you want to feed the monkeys, you have to walk some distance and then feed them at some distance so that they don't create a disturbance around one's living place. Okay, so he says, the one who comes last, he'll throw the food away where there's no greenery, or put it into water where there is no life. Then he puts away the seats, the drinking water, and the washing water. He'll put away the refuse bucket after washing it, and then he'll sweep out the refectory. Okay, then, this is a problem we don't quite have in the U.S., but in the traditional society where we don't have running water coming through the tap, there's water to use in the toilets, water to use in the kitchen for washing utensils. And so sometimes that water runs low, and so if one sees that it's running low, then one should take the vessel to the place where one stores the water, fill it, and bring it back. Okay, but then if the vessel is too heavy, what Anuruddha says is that we call somebody else by a signal of the hand, has a kind of hand gesture to call a person, and then together they will lift that heavy water vessel and carry it and bring it to the appropriate place. But he says, on this occasion, we don't break into speech. So for 4 days out of the five, they're observing together noble silence. Even though they're arahats, so they can't have any disturbance to their meditation, but it seems that they just want to have a mind which is completely free from an obligation to engage in conversation. And especially for maybe worldly people, even monks who are living meditative lives, sometimes if one person starts speaking, the other person will have to reply, and that will spark off a conversation which will develop, unfold, and then the talk goes on and on and on, maybe for an hour, 2 hours, and then when you leave the conversation, the mind is disturbed and it takes very diligent practice to settle it again. So he says, during these days we don't break out into speech, but every 5 days we sit together throughout the night discussing the Dharma. So he says, that is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Okay, then the Buddha says, while you abide thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, have you attained any superhuman state, any distinction and knowledge worthy of the Noble One, a comfortable abiding or dwelling at ease? You see, Anuruddha's explanation here, a statement of what they're doing, doesn't indicate their practice of meditation explicitly. And yet the Buddha's question, while you're dwelling thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, he's asking whether you have achieved anything. And yet he hasn't touched on the meditation practice. It seems almost as though a paragraph had fallen out from the sutta, in which they explained how they conducted their meditation. Because now Anuruddha replies by answering how they've attained what is called an Uttari Manusa Dhamma, which means a superhuman state, an Alam Arya Jnana Dasana Viseso, that's some excellent attainment of knowledge and vision worthy of the Noble Ones. And then he says, here, Venerable Sir, whenever we want, secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, we enter and dwell in the first jhana, the first meditative absorption, accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. That is a superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision that we attain as we dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute. Okay, then the Buddha asks whether you've achieved any higher distinction in knowledge and vision. And Anuruddha explains how they've all achieved the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Then he goes on to explain how they've all achieved, I'm going down a little quickly, paragraph 14, how they've all achieved the base of the infinity of space. This is the first of the formless meditations. Then he goes on to explain how they've all achieved the base of the infinity of consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So they've all achieved the four jhanas and the four formless meditations. Okay, then the Buddha asks, paragraph 18, is there any further superhuman state, distinction in knowledge and vision that you've attained? Then Anuruddha explains how they have all achieved the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. So he says, whenever we want, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, And we enter and dwell in the cessation of perception and feeling. And then he indicates that they've all achieved the destruction of the defilements. In other words, that they've all achieved arhatship. So he says, and our taints are destroyed by our seeing with wisdom. So this is another superhuman state that we've all attained. And then he says, we do not see any other comfortable abiding or dwelling at ease higher or more sublime than this one. Then the Buddha confirms this and he says, good, good, Anuruddha. There is no other comfortable abiding higher or more sublime than that one. Okay, then the Buddha apparently gives them some further talk in order to, it says that he instructed, urged, roused, and gladdened them. But since they're all arhats, they don't really have to be urged or roused. But this is just a stock expression to indicate that the Buddha gave them some talk to inspire them. Okay, then the Buddha decides that it's time to leave, so he gets up and departs. And the other monks go with him part of the way and then turn back. Now I'm in paragraph 20. And then this is an interesting part of this sutta. The two other friends of Anuruddha, Venerable Kimbila and Venerable Nandiya and Venerable Kimbila, say to Anuruddha, they ask him, have we ever reported to you that we have obtained those attainments which you yourself ascribe to us in the presence of our teacher, the Buddha? And so this is interesting because I have to say nowadays somebody maybe does a little meditation, you know, they maybe do an intensive course, an extended course, 1 month, 2 months, and then they're always thinking, oh, have I gotten enlightenment? Have I gotten enlightenment yet? And then maybe, you know, they go to the teacher, they report their experience. Maybe the teacher says something like, mm-hmm. And then they say, ah, the teacher is saying that I've gotten enlightenment. Oh, so so-and-so has practiced under this teacher, that teacher, and he was confirmed by this one is getting enlightenment, by that one is getting enlightenment. And so then, you know, it goes out on the internet and broadcast all over the world so people know that such and such a person has studied with this one, that one, and he's been confirmed to have reached enlightenment under those teachers. But here these are three very advanced meditating monks who've been good friends maybe for years. And they don't even report to one another about their attainments. There's another story that comes in Visuddhimagga about, not quite up to this level, but two monks who were very good friends, and one of them observed what is called the sitting practice. The sitting practice means that it's a vow that one makes not to lie down to sleep, but one sits in the sitting posture. And so when one really masses it, one doesn't even lean against the wall, but one is able just to sit in the ordinary meditation posture, and one is able to fall asleep maybe for a few hours, and that becomes enough so that when one wakes up, one is refreshed. I know of a few very advanced meditation masters who have observed that. Back in my very early days as a monk, when I heard that some advanced meditators have done that, I have to try it myself. So I leaned against the wall of my bedroom or the cottage where I was living. Then after about 15 minutes, the pillow starts singing a song. We are lonely for your head tonight. wouldn't you like to lie down? And I look at the pillow and say, did you say something? And then the pillow says, why are you avoiding us tonight? Did we do something offensive to you? Did we insult you or hurt you in some way? And I said to the pillow, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to leave you all alone tonight. Let me keep you company. Then the next morning I thought, what a lazy fellow. Tonight I will do it. Make a vow to stay up all night. But didn't succeed. The song of the pillow was just too sweet and enticing. Okay, so, I'm sorry, I got a little distracted. So, of these two monks who were friends, one of them observed the sitting practice, and since they were living each in their own kuti, their own little hut, you know, for all the time, the one who was observing the practice never told his friend that he was observing this practice. And the friend, of course, didn't even know that his friend was observing this practice. But one time they were traveling together and they had to stay overnight at some monastery. And the monastery, the guest master in the monastery said, I'm sorry, but we don't have separate rooms for you tonight. We'll have to put you, both of you, in the same room. And so two monks went into the same room. You know, they would have sat meditating during the early part of the night. And so the monk who was not observing the sitting practice probably got tired first, and he lay down to go to sleep, whereas the other monk remained in the sitting posture. Okay, then in the middle of the night, the monk who was lying down got up, and he noticed his friend sitting in meditation. And he said to him, the idea came to me, he must be observing the sitting posture. I said, the sitting practice. He said, are you an observer of the sitting practice? And his friend was so modest, he didn't want even his close friend to know that he was observing that practice. And so he decided, even though he had made that vow, in order to protect his sort of privacy and to maintain his modesty, he lay down in the bed and said, no friend, I had just come back from going to the latrine and I was just sitting for a few moments before lying down again. Then probably when his friend fell asleep, then he got up and resumed his sitting practice. Okay, so coming back to the sutta, Anuruddha now explains that, he says that even though you never reported to me your attainments, but I have used my own mind in order to look into your minds. This is the power of knowing the minds of others. And I have known that you have achieved those attainments. And then Anuruddha also had frequent conversations with the deities. Maybe you believe this, maybe you don't. But this is what is reported. And the deities would be able to read the minds of human beings. And they knew that his friends had reached these various meditative absorptions and arhatship, and they had reported this to Anuruddha. Okay, so that ends the conversation between the monks, and now a certain spirit, I think this is a yaksha, one of the fierce spirits, comes to the Buddha and tells the Buddha that it is a gain for the Vajjayans. The Vajjayans will be the people, you know, the residents of that state where these three monks are living. It is a gain for them, a great gain, that the Tathagata is living amongst them, and these three young men, Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila, are living here. So when the Yaksha, Diga Parajana, exclaims this, then the earth gods utter that same exclamation. Then that same exclamation goes up from one realm of the gods to another realm of the gods to another realm of the gods, until the deities of the Brahma world shout out, it is a gain for the Bhajians, a great gain for them, that the Buddha is living amongst them and these three young monks. And so at that time, these venerable ones were known even as far as the Brahma world. Okay, then the Buddha tells this yaksha, this spirit, so it is, so it is. And then he says, this is quite a moving passage, if the clan or family from which these three young men have gone forth into the homeless life remember these young men with confident heart, with a mind of faith and devotion, that will lead to the welfare and happiness of that clan, that family, for a long time. And if the people in the retinue of that clan remember these young men in this way, if the people in the village, the town, the city, the country remember these, think of these young men in such a way, that will lead to the well-being and happiness of the country for a long time. If all of the members of the Kshatriya clan, the nobles or aristocrats, remember them, that will lead to the welfare and happiness of the nobles. And so for the Brahmins, the merchants, the workers, remember these three clansmen with trusting hearts, that will lead to the welfare of the Brahmins, the Vaishyas, the Shudras, for a long time. Then if the whole world with its gods, Maras, Brahmas, and so on, remember these three young men with trusting hearts, that would lead to the welfare and happiness of the world for a long time. And the Buddha says, see how these three young men are practicing for the welfare and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the good welfare and happiness of the gods and human beings. Okay, and that is the end of the sutta. Okay, if anybody has any questions, then please feel welcome to ask.
Just a little comment. It says they would spend all night discussing the Dhamma every 5 days, but apparently they wouldn't discuss meditation or.
Yeah, it struck me too.
What it was they were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say it is a little bit strange that they could discuss the Dhamma without giving some indication of their experience. Yeah. And then certainly if they're speaking, say, if one is speaking about the jhanas, you know, one would get the suspicion, is he speaking from direct experience or is he just quoting the books so there aren't any books? And if he's just quoting the books or what they've heard from the Buddha, they probably have all heard this, so there's nothing really additional to report. And then if he's speaking beyond what the Buddha himself has said about the jhanas or about the insight knowledges, you know, you could pretty much tell when somebody is speaking from direct experience and when he's just quoting what the books say. So it seems almost as though, well, it often occurs to me, I have to say, that sometimes the suttas are framed and worded not to conform to our realistic expectations, but to convey messages. And so, like, the message is, you know, to be modest about one's own attainments and not to go boasting about it to others immediately. Okay, let's take Treya.
It's a bit rude to go looking into someone else's mind. It always strikes me, like, here, that's what it strikes me there was you in the internet land, my question, my comment was,
I read
someone's mind. Witchcraft, that's known as overlooking, which is considered a dodgy practice.
It's considered a what? Wait.
Overlooking.
Considered a what practice? Dodgy, you said?
Dodgy, it's really dodgy. Not good, bad.
I have to say, I mean, when I, you know, we hear that maybe the National Security Agency is listening in on our phone calls.
We don't expect morality from them.
Yeah. I have to say, it struck me too, yeah. But, well, the Buddha doesn't. You know, and it's not only that the Buddha does it with monks that he knows to be arhats. Sometimes, you know, he finds, what is that monk thinking about? Has he been reading Playboy in his spare time? Then he'll come over and scold a monk. You shouldn't be thinking in that way, but you should be thinking in this way. Okay.
I was struck with the story of the one monk declining to reveal that he was practicing the sitting posture for the sake of the other monk.
Yeah, maybe just let's hold off a few seconds till this. It seems exceptionally loud today. And exceptionally long. Okay, please.
You related something in the sutra which one of the monks said to the other monk that he was not practicing the sitting posture as he was sleeping. Did I do that correctly?
Actually, if I said that, he wouldn't have said that, because that would have been false speech.
Well, that's why I raised the question.
Yeah.
Was he not telling the truth when he said he was practicing in order to spare the other monk's feelings as out of method?
It just struck me that, because I'm just relating this story from a vague recollection of it. I didn't, you know, review the story before I came to the class. But almost certainly he would not have spoken falsely, but he would have done something so that without speaking falsely, he would have dispelled the impression that he was observing the sitting practice.
That's pretty clever.
I'll have to check out the story on that point. Does anybody have a copy of Visuddhi Magga with them? Yes, okay, Richard?
In that case, instead of speaking falsely, isn't he signaling or acting falsely? I mean, it's still a false communication.
Again, I'd have to look at the story to see how it takes place. But again, it might be a fictional story to convey the importance of sort of modesty about one's practices. But I have to say exactly what the story says.
Oh, I mean, whatever the story is, I mean, presumably there aren't many incidents like that.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is it's easy to deceive oneself about the forms of one's own deception. You know, there are all kinds of politenesses which are meant to conceal things that you don't want other people to know.
Yeah.
There are lots of ways of, I mean, there are enormous numbers of ways of deceiving oneself and others.
Yeah.
You have to.
No.
Like false speech doesn't really say it all. There are false actions and there are false gestures and the words.
I'll have to take another look at the story. Okay, we'll take one more question and then we'll have to break for lunch.
I know that you mentioned the conspicuous lack of a reference to meditation, but I wonder if the sutta means to suggest that if we live in a more deliberate way, keeping more silent, is that a way to attain, it's at least the first jhana in the midst of ordinary activity?
I'd say certainly the kind of way in which the monks conduct themselves is to be understood as conducive to their meditative attainments. But usually the expression dwelling diligent, ardent, and resolute, it's almost a standard part of the way the suttas are framed, that it's connected with the practice of meditation. And yet, it seems as though something had been dropped from the sutta, or had been missing. That's what I would have expected to see something. It could be something like, there's a passage on what's called wakefulness, where they dwell during the day, sitting and walking back and forth, and sitting, and then they lie down in the middle of the night, mindful and clearly comprehending, and then they wake up in the last part of the night, and then they spend the time sitting and walking back and forth. And usually that's it, dispelling, removing obstructive states from the mind, which means defilements. But since these are arhats, they wouldn't have obstructive states anymore. Okay, let me just take the one internet question, then we will break for lunch. Can right view and wrong view live in harmony? I think he means, can people with right view and wrong view live in harmony? I think it depends on the degree of harmony. If people have different views, if the wrong view is not a very grave or serious wrong view, that will lead them to morally disruptive conduct, I say they can achieve a fair degree of harmony, providing they behave properly. But at a higher level, maybe that they can't live together harmoniously. Okay, let us end with the sharing of the merits, so that the devas of the earth deities will share in the merits, the devas of the four great kings, the Tavatimsa devas, all the ways up to the Brahma world will share in our merits. Akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyam tang anumoditva chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyam tang anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasa ta jabuma ta Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantam Anumodipa Chiram Rakantu Mamparam Eta Vataja Amhehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabe Satanumodantu Saba Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadhaya vichihe tato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pasantu nibhutin. Okay, let us do 3,000.